Today is Wednesday. It's May 7th, 2025. It's 2:42 in the afternoon. Hi, this is John Williams. This is the Mincing Rascals podcast, the podcast for people who care about Chicago. Listen to me weekdays on WGN Radio from 10 to 2.
I'm Austin Berg from the Illinois Policy Institute and co-founder of Ironlight, a marketing agency working to change the world. You can check out my Substack, The Last Ward.
Marge Halperin, award-winning journalist, communications consultant, community activist, doing what I can to challenge authority.
I'm Eric Zorn, the nationally famous now publisher of the Picayune Sentinel on Substack. And I'm nationally famous because just this morning, Austin and I appeared on a national podcast in which we didn't really debate the issues, but we just spoke of them. So I would urge Mincing Rascals listeners to check us out on a podcast called Not Even Mad.
What's the thrust of that?
Mike Pesca, the host, who is a Mincing Rascals listener, by the way, in New York, he invited us on just to talk about issues of the day. We talked about Pritzker and politics and national debt. And what else did we talk about, Austin? Do you remember?
Talked about Pritzker, national debt. Talked about what annoys us. I talked about my TV doesn't work, which is kind of embarrassing.
Wait a minute, but these are things you are mad about. Isn't the podcast called Not Even Mad?
I know. It's confusing. The last segment is what you are mad about.
We talk about issues without getting really mad at each other, which
we've been able to do
on this podcast for a long time. Austin and I are good at that. But Mike usually brings on a couple of people to spar, but in a civilized way. It's an interesting show. It's good, no Mincing Rascals.
Congressman Raja Krishnamurthy rolled out his introduction video last night. The Democrat from Illinois' 8th, the congressman, is running for Dick Durbin's Senate seat, and his platform is Turn Anger into Action. I don't know if you guys saw it, but I just thought it was interesting that while he mentions his accomplishments as a congressman over a few terms, he then goes right away at video of Elon Musk and Donald Trump. And it's almost like a campaign ad. Of course, it would be. But I mean, his platform is Trump and the billionaires are bad. They're doing a bad job. We're angry at them. Let's turn anger into action. I also asked him about the fact that the governor and the other U.S. senator have both endorsed the lieutenant governor. And how does he feel about that? JB's unmatched wealth and name recognition of Tammy Duckworth are now going to go to Juliana Stratton, who people don't know that well at all. And he said, no, that's okay, which I guess is very, very Raja. But also, I don't think he was being completely candid with us when he said, that's all right. You know, I welcome her. They're all good people. I like them. We're going to run a good campaign.
It's interesting that he's going after Musk and Trump right away. That does, you know, hit the right nerve, probably. We're all thinking about that. And it makes his rollout different from the others so far. Juliana Stratton is sort of, you don't know me, but I got some really important friends, you know, and if they like me, you'll like me too. That's not what her pitch was, but it's coming down to that now, right?
Yeah, right.
Robin Kelly rolled out
Chicago area congresswoman.
Yeah. So she rolled out with her own history of fighting against everyday gun violence and had some really emotional clips and talking about the stand. She also, which I didn't remember myself, was the leader of the sit down that happened in the House protesting Trump and fighting against the repeal of Obamacare. I remember all the participation, but I didn't realize she started it. And so she put her own best points forward, and they're all going to do it a little different way. And we have, I think, an embarrassment of riches. I think they're all great candidates, and it'll be really interesting to see how the campaign plays out.
And that's without even getting to Lauren Underwood and some other people who would be credible candidates.
But I hope she jumps in.
It does seem like in Raja's case, though, guys, he is saying, okay, never mind everybody south of I-80. He is going to run on the Chicago vote in the suburbs, which is where the voters are. But I think running a campaign against Donald Trump and you're angry, we're angry, let's go get him, is marginalizing geographically about 4/5 of the state.
Well, John, yes, but you got to remember he's running in the Democratic primary first, and Democratic primary voters, even downstate, are going to resonate a lot with that. Now, when it comes to the general election, I think what you're just discussing is more of an issue.
They won't remember that then, Eric?
You moderate your position. It's kind of an old political trick, right? You run to your party's base, and then you moderate during the general election. Donald Trump didn't do that, but a lot of candidates have done it. I wanted to bring up the column today by Laura Washington in the Tribune, in Wednesday's Tribune, where she essentially says that she sort of, in some ways, I felt like she was warning off Underwood from running, because that would make three African-American women with Stratton, Kelly, and Underwood. And she was saying that they may just end up splitting the vote of African-American women who tend to vote in pretty good numbers. But if you divide that vote up three ways, that's going to leave an opening for somebody else to come in. I was wondering what the panel thinks about that observation. Is that I got the feeling that she was telling the three of them to get together and draw straws or play rock, paper, scissors and have just one of them.
The women will split their votes against among those women.
And the analogy that came to my mind was when Jane Byrne and Richie Daley split the white vote in Chicago back in 1983, and that left an opening for Harold Washington to win the mayor's office with about, I think it was like 36% of the vote.
And do you think it's the gender more than the race issue? Raja is a man of color, for what it's worth. I don't know if any of these things are going to be factors in people's decisions.
I don't know, and I'm not even sure that I buy Laura's basic point, which is that that black women are going to separate all that they're not going to judge these candidates on their merits and pick the one that they'd like the best, or pick a white guy or Raja if they feel like that's the right candidate. But it was an interesting thing to think about.
Yeah, identity politics are a real thing.
It would be exciting to elect any person of color to this position at this time. I think they're all, as I said, I think they're all great candidates, and I'm a fan of Lauren Underwood's too. Worked hard to get her elected the first last couple of elections, and hope she does stay in Congress one way or the other. So I, a primary is a shakeout time, and it's so early to think about who's going to rise and how the vote's going to split. I wish Laura had waited to write that column just a little later, when we could learn a little more about each candidate and how they are running their campaign and what their promise is as a potential senator, because ultimately it's that, right? We know what you're mad about. I don't know why there's a whole podcast about it. We're mad about everything that Trump is doing, but is that what you run on? Where's your vision? If you get to the Senate, how are you going to build a new vision for the Democratic Party? And boy, that question better be answered sooner than later. And I'm not exactly seeing that in any of these announcements, but that's ultimately what we need to see. And that's why you have a long campaign. Same reason you have 9 months of pregnancy. It takes a little time for things to develop.
Black women, I believe, are the most loyal demographic in terms of Democratic primary voters nationwide. I don't know if that boils down in Illinois. I expect it does. So I get why there's attention being paid to it. The thing I'm looking for in this race is everyone who's announced or is said to announce soon is somewhat of an insider, right? I mean, they may have been outsider to politics at some point, but they're a sitting congressperson, a sitting state senator, a sitting lieutenant governor. And it puts them in a difficult position, and maybe a vulnerable position, depending on where the winds go, because it makes room for potentially someone to come in who is willing to very openly criticize the Democratic Party. And we talk a lot about Trump's favorables being terrible, but Democratic Party favorables are also not great. And to win, I think there is a lane in Democratic primaries right now for people, especially if on the issue of Gaza, where there is enormous energy around that issue and enormous anger at current Democrats in power. And no one's running in that lane yet for the Illinois Senate seat. There is some of that. You see just the inklings of that in Jan Schakowsky's seat, her competitor, very young woman, very online, very
progressive,
in tune with issues in the further left of the party. And in a crowded field, you could see someone like that take, 15% of the vote and kind of sneak by.
Yeah, I believe that's true, because when Jan Schakowsky bowed out on Monday, That opened the door for a number of candidates, Daniel Biss being certainly one of them, mayor of Evanston, former gubernatorial hopeful, to get into that race. And you could see I lived in the 5th District in Chicago, Mike Quigley's district, and when he won the election, I'm not sure how many years ago it was now, but there was a huge field of candidates all wanting to be in Congress. So it didn't take a lot to win that primary. Now, since then, he's just hung on to that seat without any trouble. But that could easily happen up in the 9th District, where you could have 6, 7, 8 candidates with different constituencies, yeah. And that would open the door for someone like Kat, who has a very different take on things. She's very pro-Palestinian. I think she may even have Palestinian roots. So she wouldn't have been able to beat Schakowsky one-on-one. She jumped in back in March. She's got some liabilities. She doesn't not from here, but when you've got a multi-candidate field like that, anything can happen. And we certainly saw that happen in 2019 when we had 14 candidates running for mayor and Lori Lightfoot slid into the final against Tony Preckwinkle. Preckwinkle got 16% of the vote in 2019 and got into the final two. Took a little bit more than that when there were 9 candidates in 2023, but the possibility for outsiders like Austin's talking about, people who are not the first names that come to mind, it becomes larger and larger the more candidates.
Do you all know why this Kat Abigazela decided to run? She's from Dallas, right? Why did she decide to run in Chicago? I'm not for or against her. I don't know anything about her.
She says that her partner got some sort of business opportunity up here. And I don't know what that opportunity was. I don't know anything about her partner, but she was born in the Dallas area. She moved to Tucson, then she was in Washington D.C. voted in Washington D.C. last November. So she is a classic kind of carpetbagger.
She doesn't know anything. Like, what's it? Chicago Magazine interviewed her, and they said, "Okay, just let's ask some things about your district or the city in general. What landmark is it? To what is it? 1060 Addison or whatever? What's the address for Wrigley Field?" And if you gave me the address, I would know it. I'm not recalling the numbers off the top of my head, but she goes, "Oh, I don't know." And everything she goes, "Oh, cool," or "I'd like to know about that." She did know some things, but wow, did she not know nuts and bolts things. Austin, what?
She has two advantages. One, she's got her own megaphone every single day, and she's good at new media, and she only needs one person to do it, and she can reach a pretty substantial audience doing that. And that's not no other candidate for that race is going to be able to do that for 2 years, guaranteed. Like, she's going to be alone in that for a while. And the second thing, because I think the Lori Lightfoot comparison is apt just in this way, probably not in many other ways, she was the first, and she proved she was not afraid to challenge the person who's incumbent. Everybody else who's coming in at this point, it's like, oh, okay, now that it's like an open field, you're coming in, and she can. It's very fair of her to criticize other people for that, but she's not, which is also like a likable thing. She was saying she was welcoming people to come in. She said, "Anyone who wants to join the race, I'll help you file your FEC paperwork." And I don't know if that's sincere or not, but I love that politically. Like, that's a great thing to say, I think.
But this is not selfless on her part, Austin. If she gets more and more
she just screws it up like she does.
No, she dilutes the field. She can elevate herself with fewer
votes.
That's
true, too.
Yeah, I think that's what that's about. I mean, there is that.
I love it.
Magnanimity, it's going to be interesting. But the whole race could end up being a real cluster event. So
I'm not sure I would trust my opponent in any race to file my paperwork for me.
Sure, I'll help you with that paperwork.
Yeah, no, but you're also kind of queuing up my rant about how we need ranked choice voting, which we do. So I won't go into any more detail about it than that. But we're going to keep having these overcrowded fields and mediocre candidates that rise to the top if we don't do something about that. But otherwise, I'll just say, Austin, you know, one man's outsider is another person's inexperienced, unqualified, underqualified candidate. So there's something to be said for the insiders who understand Congress, absolutely for the Senate. Like, I don't believe a novice belongs in the Senate. On the House, I used to think that was a little more entry level or for different kinds of experience and knowledge. But the way Republicans have flooded the House with just idiots who don't know a darn thing about government, makes me wonder if we don't want somebody who moves their way through the ranks just a little bit. I mean, on the other hand, we have a president who doesn't think he has to uphold the Constitution. So lack of knowledge about your job is not a disqualifier necessarily.
We watched the movie Charlie Wilson's War. I was telling producer Pete about that today. And that's a great movie. Tom Hanks plays this kind of rogue congressman who was instrumental in the war in Afghanistan. Charlie Wilson, though, was a wonk. Even though he was a playboy, a gadfly, he wasn't a sane, sober individual all of the time. But he really cared about and understood the international players and the workings of Congress. That was Charlie Wilson. And I'm also just finishing that book, Madhouse, written by a couple of New York Times congressional reporters, and where they talk about Marjorie Taylor Greene and Boebert and all of these other crazy people that are in that one wing of the Republican Party. Anyway, the contrast between somebody like Wilson last night just reminding me what a wonk he was, how much he cared about the issue, studied it, knew it, tried to figure out what we need to do about it. And then Marjorie Taylor Greene, who, when Mike Johnson was telling her about how bad it would be if Russia won the war in Ukraine or took more land, and he said, "You need to see what I know. Let's set up a briefing for you." She said, "No, I don't need a briefing. I don't believe him." He said, "It's our own intelligence committee." She said, "That's the problem." And he could not convince her to pay attention to any of the facts on the ground. Not only was she not maybe intellectually capable of it, but she wasn't even curious. It's a really fun book. It'll break your heart. The blurb on the back by one of the people that reviewed the book said, "Every once in a while, there is a book that comes along that restores your faith in humanity. This is not one of those books."
I could see the punchline coming.
I know.
You're right about curiosity, and I see this with a lot of Trump's followers, the MAGA followers as well. They're not curious. They don't look at any other news source. They don't question the information that is put in front of them. Literally, Trump right now thinks he can tell you enough times that your groceries have gotten cheaper and you will believe him, even though you're
march
paying
to
more
march
and more
up.
Every time you
march
go.
To march, they're up.
Or that gas is $1.98 a gallon.
He keeps saying that. It's not true. We check it every time he says it. There's no one in America that you can get gas under $2.10. You know, I'm thinking that they ought to just tell somebody in Oklahoma, some guy running a gas station, "Would you please sell it for $1.97 so we can say it's true?" Because he keeps saying it, and it's not. They can't get one MAGA gas station owner to do him a solid here. That's maybe they will, but I mean, otherwise, it's not true.
They don't need the facts.
Well, that's true.
It doesn't have to be true. Nothing else he says is true. He puts executive orders out that are illegal. They're like, "See me in court. I don't care." Like, they're in a different world. And to your point about this movie and what you're reading, there's not a curiosity. There's a willingness just to accept what you're being told by someone you admire without any curiosity as to finding out the facts.
I just want to go back to something about the U.S. Senate seat that Raja and others are running for, Dick Durbin's seat, which he's going to vacate at the end of the term. And Eric, you were talking about how maybe three women of color might split a vote. And as we were talking about that, I was just making a note to myself of all the people of color and women of color who have had major roles in Illinois and Cook County and Chicago government. Lori Lightfoot and Brandon Johnson and Janice Jackson. I mean, if you think about the state's attorney, the attorney general, the mayors, county board chief, police chief, so many of these. I know. I mean, you just go on. You would be hard-pressed to find a white guy. I don't know that being a white male is an advantage or disadvantage or if it's a non-factor, but we have largely been governed by women of color here in Chicago. I'm not passing judgment on that at all. It's probably demographically representative, but it is that.
I was talking with a city council member who told me, I was talking with them last week, they said the first time they sat down with Brandon Johnson, he said, and this was when Brandon Johnson was soliciting an endorsement, he said, "You know, the way you get a Latino mayor is through me." And to even just have a prominent elected official kind of thinking that way, I don't think Brandon Johnson's at all alone in doing that. I'm also not even sure what he means by that. But that has been such a huge part of Chicago's politics, more so than any other big city, I would argue, in the last 30 years. And it's partially, it's very largely a function of how segregated geographically we are as a city.
Can you break that down, Austin? What was he inferring there?
I think he was inferring, this person, you know, what you ultimately want is a Latino mayor. So I'm going to help you get that in some way. Now, what's kind of odd is that I think through his failure as a mayor, I think we are more likely than ever to have a Latino mayor.
Guess what? That'll work just fine.
But he was saying it from the perspective of, and you look at the citywide offices, right? The clerk and the treasurer, it's just sort of like common knowledge. And we're supposed to be like, okay with this, that like, oh, the clerk, that is a Latino seat, and the treasurer, that is a Black seat. And it's just like so parochial and like antiquated and bizarre. And that's just the way our political culture is in Chicago.
It's a city that couldn't honor Martin Luther King Day without having a Pulaski Day. I mean, we've always been allocating on a basis of race. Once the long-term white control of the city got a couple cracks in it, they're like, okay, here's how we're going to split it up then.
I mean, the fact that there is quite a few African-Americans in power in Cook County, it diminishes the claim that Lori Lightfoot and Brandon Johnson made, which is like, oh, you're only picking on me because I'm Black, or Lori Lightfoot, you're picking on me because I'm a woman or I'm gay. There are enough Black people in power that you can't say that voters are, the reason that Brandon Johnson is mayor is because a sufficient number, of white progressives voted for him over Paul Vallis. So let's not say that the city is so racist that it can't elect African Americans. It clearly has up and down the ballot. Carol Moseley Braun was the first Black woman in the U.S. Senate, or we are quite likely, or not, I would not say that. I'll say it's possible that we will have a Black woman succeeding Dick Durbin. So anyway, I mean, but identity voting, I think, is still a big deal. And again, I'm not necessarily saying that Laura Washington is correct, that those three Black women are going to just divide up the Black female vote and open the door for someone to sail through. But it's certainly a possibility to think about.
Former Governor George Ryan has passed away since we last spoke, and his obit is complicated. Nothing perhaps more complicated about his legacy than his role in the tragic death of the Willis family children. And that's not even why he went to jail. Eric, why don't you start?
Well, the story, is that what kicked off the licenses for bribes investigation that ended up putting George Ryan in prison for almost 6 years was this terrible car crash up near Milwaukee in November of 1994, there was a truck that was being driven by a man who had paid a bribe to get his commercial driver's license at the Illinois Secretary of State's office.
There was a language issue with that guy, right? I don't know that he spoke English.
Yeah, there are various issues with him, and he was driving up toward Fond du Lac. I think he was headed toward Fond du Lac, and he had a mud flap assembly near the taillight that fell off his truck and bounced on the pavement up into the gas tank of the minivan that the Willises were driving in. And the mother and father got out, but the six children who were in the van burned to death. And this was, was a horrible tragedy. And this was a headline, but certainly prominently mentioned in almost all the obituaries for Ryan. And not to defend Ryan so much, but to put it into context, I pointed out that he didn't take a bribe from Ricardo Guzman. He didn't order that his employees take bribes. His employees were taking bribes in many cases so they could have the money to buy tickets to his fundraisers. And he certainly ought to have known about it. He claimed that he didn't know that this was happening. But you got to remember that this truck was faulty. This truck had a bad assembly. It wasn't like he was driving unsafely. He was driving down the road. He didn't have a CB radio. He didn't have one on. And some truckers were honking and pointing at him, but he didn't really know what that meant. So you have a whole line of responsible parties, you have the company that leased the chassis, the company that maintained the chassis, the trucking company that supervised Guzman, the company that oversaw the dispatching in the truck yard and didn't look at the equipment, didn't provide the proper inspections for it. So there's a whole bunch of people who are responsible for this George Ryan and the way things ran under the Secretary of State's office was also responsible. But there's no way of saying for sure that a properly licensed trucker would not have had the same thing happen on the same truck at the same time. So it's like, you know, it was a terrible, terrible sequence of events. And Ryan was part of the chain of events, but he wasn't like, he wasn't as responsible as I think a lot of the stories are led you to believe.
But it was the crack that opened the door to learn about this whole bribery issue, right?
Yes. Yes, definitely was. It definitely was. It was a very pivotal moment. And another thing is that Ryan, rather than facilitating the investigation into licenses for bribes, tried to shut it down, which was an infamous thing to do at that time.
As I recall, at the Secretary of State's office, maybe they would leave an envelope with money or something on the driver's seat. And when the person that was going to check you out got in the cab, he would see that, and that was the deal. And then you get your license, and maybe you would be a qualified driver, maybe you wouldn't. You ought to be able to read and speak English if you're going to be driving a big old semi. Wasn't the last thing, didn't he have a roll of $100 bills or a wad of cash in his pocket, and he was in Florida or somewhere? I'm just piecing together little parts of my memory.
This is part of the trouble. I just got to point out that the 92-page indictment, federal indictment that's brought down against Ryan, did not mention the Willis family tragedy. It was not part of the indictment,
right?
And it was not much of it came up at the trial. But yeah, I mean, he was doing things like taking Christmas gifts from janitors and stuff. I mean, it was just kind of grubby and gross, just unseemly the way he conducted himself in terms of raising money like that. And so he would have these fundraisers, and this was at the time when you're, as an employee of the Secretary of State's office, you were expected to buy tickets and contribute to his campaign fund. Again, I mean, I think that's unconscionable when you've got these people who are, you know, making a modest living, and you're wealthy George Ryan, and you're shaking them upside down for their money. I mean, that was really crummy. So yeah, I mean, you're right about that, and I have a lot of issues with the way he conducted himself in that regard. But, you know, the fact that the Willis family, I mean, it's terrible what happened to them, but that I don't think that you can really point the finger and say, if only George Ryan had not been corrupt, this
right.
wouldn't have happened.
Right.
That's not at all clear. It's not at all clear to me that some of these employees might have taken bribes for their own, could buy themselves a new television set for all that. I mean, so it's not, the linkage is weak in that particular instance.
You know, if we're going to talk about George Ryan, the other thing that comes to mind is Illinois is no longer a capital punishment state.
Yeah, definitely part of the Republican combine, as it were, with Edgar and Ryan and Jim Thompson. Not the most ethical party or operation for many decades. The unspoken arrangement, similar to the one I described with the treasurer's office and the clerk's office in Illinois for a long time, was that sort of the Democrats get to have all the patronage in Chicago and Cook County, and the Republicans get to have all their patronage jobs in Springfield. And he was absolutely part of that. I thought what he did with the death penalty commuting, basically putting a moratorium on it, was very brave. I think that was in, do you know the year of that off the top of your head, John? Was that like,
it was like 2000. It was supposed to be 2000.
I think 2000 is right. And yeah. We did at the Illinois Policy Institute a few years ago, one of my favorite events we ever did was at Aurora University, and it was with Rolando Cruz, whose case was really one of the main reasons why that moratorium was happened. And then ultimately, I believe Governor Quinn signed the moratorium into law years later. And it's called, you can watch it on YouTube, it's called Questions of Justice, the Nicarico Murder Case. And it's a really cool interview, not only with Rolando, who does not speak publicly very much, but with his attorney, with folks in law enforcement at the time. And the case is just fascinating. For people who don't know, it was in 1985, Rolando Cruz and his friend Alejandro were tried and wrongfully convicted and sent to death row for the murder of a 10-year-old girl named Janine Nicarico in Naperville. And they just spent years in prison fearing death for a crime that they did not commit. It turned out it was a serial killer who did it, who they found years later. But fascinating case, and it was definitely brave of Ryan to do that.
I will never forget him, you know, pretty figuratively and kind of literally standing on the Capitol steps, blocking the ERA in the early 80s. Illinois was pivotal to the momentum and considered a a slam dunk. It was a state that should have done it. It was also the state of Phyllis Schlafly, who was a pal of Ryan's and lobbied against it. But he made a rule. He was Speaker of the House at the time, and he made a rules change instead of a simple majority, which the heads were counted and we had the vote. He changed it to a three-fifths majority, a higher bar, in the middle of the debate, and couldn't be met, and Illinois passed. Finally passed it many years later, you know, the whole dispute about whether it was too late, the deadline's passed. We still don't have the ERA. As someone who fought for that as a college student, I'm shocked and dismayed that we don't have that in place, and George Ryan is a key reason why not.
Hmm. Yeah, how pivotal was that in terms of the national fight for the ERA?
Well, that was the momentum. There were three states left, and Illinois was to do it, and I think Virginia was one to follow, and then what I don't remember what the third one was, but there was a steamroller happening. There was a lot of momentum and a lot of attention for it, and Illinois was a major piece of the dominoes that had to fall. So when he stopped it, he gave other states the nod and the incentive to stop it there too, and made Phyllis Schlafly even more powerful than she seemed to already be, and created the momentum for the other side.
Before we get to our attraction distraction segment, we haven't even talked about what's going on really in the Capitol and with Donald Trump, and I do want to get to that, but let's just stay in the neighborhood for a minute. Two Columbus statues are in the news this week. Both were taken down by, I think, a total of three, but the two are the ones that I was reading about, were taken down by Mayor Lori Lightfoot after the one in Grant Park became the focal point of protests and violence in 2020. The statues have been in storage, and now the Park District has struck a deal with a consortium of Italian-American groups here in Chicago. One will be loaned to the Joint Civic Committee of Italian-Americans, and they can display it on their own private property on their own. The other remains in storage, and no Columbus statue will go back to Grant Park. So is this a win for one side or the other? We now know Columbus, important but also bad. About putting one back up in Grant Park, a Columbus statue, I was somewhat persuaded by something that Mayor Brandon Johnson said, that we should not erase art and culture. And I thought, yeah, art doesn't have to be the whole truth about something. Movies and music get to tell one side. Depictions of Benjamin Netanyahu and Uncle Sam in Chicago with blood on their hands last year only told one side of the story. So put the statue back up. But then the mayor went on to say that we have to make sure that our presentations depict not just the truth, but the best part of our experience, our collective humanity, he said. So that would be Columbus out. But I like my point better. Maybe we should just resolve that these street signs and statues aren't telling the whole truth. It's part of our history. Y'all go learn it on your own.
For one, it's so ugly to not have a statue. So, like, we need to get something back up.
It's this beautiful location, and it's this ugly platform sitting there.
Yeah. And we have a statue that used to be there. I don't think it's a huge deal to put it back up. I'm totally for truth and have information about all the horrible things he did nearby. I think that's totally fair and would be a reasonable compromise. I can't say I'm too emotionally tied either way, but I would agree with the first part of Brandon Johnson's statement that you said, John.
You know, I started thinking about it in terms of what the federal government is doing, erasing history when it concerns people of color and women, taking Harriet Tubman off the website, all this kind of petty stuff. But it's not just petty, because it's real history and it's true. And then as you're talking, Austin, I'm reminded of a lot of art exhibits I've been to where artists have a sort of seamy side of their life has been exposed. And you're starting to see their art will still be displayed, but with a sign. I remember seeing a Chuck Close exhibit somewhere a couple of years ago where they would say, we exhibit this piece because of its artistic significance, but we are well aware of concerns about his private behavior. Women have filed suits against him and the things that have happened. So you could put your explanation. And finally, I think, let's limit best as we can our public tributes to something that is factual. And when they're more, let's say, symbolic to a certain group, taking them to that group's community and exhibiting there with some honest language as well makes sense to me. I agree with you about the pedestal. I can see it out my front window, and it's wrapped in plastic and rope in a goofy way. And a lot of times there's a guard standing there. It's fenced off. There's a guard there. We're guarding this ridiculous pedestal. The whole thing is just absurd. And whatever decision is made, I hope it's thoughtful and based on the truth and speedy.
I wonder if the person who on the security detail has to guard the pedestal is somebody who's in trouble. Like, all right, you screwed up last week. Guess what? You're getting the pedestal duty. No, boss.
It's a pretty good. It's a pretty sweet spot, though.
Prime I'd say it's a pretty good gig, man. Yeah. Just like get your phone and listen to podcasts.
he is always on his phone. I will say.
What else is he going to do?
Yeah. Right. It's not like anyone's going to come. Let's go tear down that pedestal. You know, I'm going to give a shout out to Mayor Johnson for pointing out that there's a distinction between art and a monument. He said the other day, a monument solidifies a position that we are honoring. But art is not necessarily telling you that you should honor an opinion or a thought. And I say that statues are neither a form of history nor a form of art, even though they are artistic renderings of historical figures. That a statue in particular is an honor. And when you look at the very, very complicated legacy of Columbus, and the fight that's going on is between the Italian-American community and the city here, and I just don't understand why Italian Americans feel like Christopher Columbus is the person that they want to have representing their heritage. Italy didn't even exist as a nation when Christopher Columbus was alive. He was from Genoa, they think. Maybe he was from Spain or Portugal. There's some doubt now about exactly where he's from. And there's so many other, you know, Italian Americans who have just made amazing contributions to our society. And you know, think of Enrico Fermi. He's local, University of Chicago. You've got Mother Cabrini. Why you would choose Christopher Columbus and this is the hill that they want to die on or fight on is pretty strange to me.
Well, I think it's a losing proposition to say, okay, as Brandon Johnson said, we only want the best part of our existence, our collective humanity. It's like celebrity endorsers, and then you find out something bad about them, and then you're, oh, crap, now what are we going to do? Mrs. Cabrini beat her dog. I didn't know that. Well, there's, you got the dog beater statue up there. We better get that thing down. So I think at some point you have to stop putting so much hope on a person or a statue or someone's history. I think those statues are art.
No, I'm saying they are artistic, and they depict historical figures, but they are primarily honors. It's an honor. It's not an art exhibit. And Johnson, when he was saying that, was drawing the distinction between this art exhibit at the Cultural Center that got everybody all worked up and the permanent statues of Columbus that were up. I mean, the artistic exhibit doesn't tell you this is that we venerate this. This is what we think you should believe. When you put up a statue of someone in a public place, you're saying our community honors this person. We think this person is singularly meritorious. And there's a lot of debate about Columbus. There's a lot of things that he did that were awful, and things that he did that were very brave and creditable. But his legacy is quite mixed. And there's a lot of ill will. It's why a lot of places, we're going to get into Trump. But, you know, Trump says he doesn't want it to be Columbus Day / Indigenous Peoples Day anymore. He wants it just to be Columbus Day. I don't know exactly what authority he has to tell the city of Chicago or any other place that does both celebrations.
But when you go back to people that far, then there goes the Jefferson statue. And good luck finding the person we can sufficiently venerate that we can put a statue up about.
What would you say mural? Would you put a mural in the same category as the statue, Eric? It's more of a monument than an art. If it's a figure,
I would. Depending on how what's in the mural, probably not. I mean, my guess is that a mural would have some context in it. Otherwise, it would be just.
I was walking south in Gold Coast yesterday, like in the evening, and if you guys have seen the north side of the Jewel Osco there, it has the murals of different authors, and there's a huge one of Ayn Rand, and I'd never seen it before, and I was like, whoa, This is
here in Chicago. Nice.
Yeah.
You're right. I'm opposed to that. As you would
expect. I forget who the others were. I think it was like James Baldwin. I can't remember who the other artists were, but it was a big, big Ayn Rand head.
I wonder who's sponsoring that, Austin.
I know.
Under whose
auspices? Jewel.
The Jewel Osco is taking a political stand. I wouldn't fight that fight if I were them. I'd sell groceries.
Problem for the Jewel.
Yeah, yeah. Let's do attraction distraction. These are issues that the president has addressed or things that he's done the last week, and they're either distractions from more important issues or they deserve our time. Trump as Pope, Alcatraz should be turned into a prison again. Never say never to Canada when their prime minister was sitting there saying that we're not for sale. 100% tariff on movies produced elsewhere. Trump as a third term president. We're going to get two dolls, girls this year, and boys, maybe instead of 30. To say nothing of the Kilmar Abrego Garcia ongoing saga.
Well, that's a lot of distractions and a couple of attractions. And a distraction that I couldn't help but fall for a little is the Alcatraz, I have to say, because the story going around, and I read a version in the Hollywood Reporter, it seems pretty legit, is that just hours before he posted that he wanted to turn this museum into a prison again, he apparently watched Escape from Alcatraz, the old Clint Eastwood movie, on a local PBS station, by the way, in South Florida, when he was standing in front of the NFL draft folks talking about bringing that to D.C., he stops to go off on Alcatraz, and they're standing there uncomfortably while he's trying to get them into talking about how great this and cruel this would be. But he goes on about no one's ever escaped except that one guy, and all they found were his chewed up clothes. That was in the movie. That didn't actually happen. So it's pretty clear he saw that movie and he thought, Alcatraz. Not only that, but it plays into this theme of cruelty. He doesn't want to just deport people. He wants to hurt them.
He said as much.
He wants them to go to Libya. He wants them to go to Rwanda. He wants them to go to Alcatraz if he could ever get it running again. It's, I spent a little time attracted by it, but I know we need to walk away. It's a distraction. It's not going to happen.
I would have to agree, and it also attracted my attention quite a bit because, first of all, I mean, the reason that they got rid of Alcatraz as a prison was it was extremely expensive because they had to, like, ship water over to that island.
Yeah, sure.
And apparently it was cost three times as much to run as a regular prison for that reason. It was very secure. I read up on it, and I think that there were some, like, five guys escaped, but they were never found, and it was pretty clear that they had died in the icy waters at the time. But yeah, it was very secure. But we have extremely secure federal prisons already. So, and it would cost, and the facility itself hasn't been a prison for, what, 60 years now, something like that? So it's, like, falling apart, and it would cost God knows how many hundreds of millions of dollars.
He said it would be about $4 million to get it back up and running again.
$4 million. I couldn't build a granny flat for $4 million.
Yeah, I thought about that, and I thought, we're getting a bathroom redone, and that's going to cost us about $4 million. I don't think Alcatraz and my bathroom have the same price tag. I'm exaggerating a little bit, but you get the
bathroom.
Okay, fine. You should see the toilets, Marge.
Gold. I'll bet they're gold.
Solid.
If I can just touch on Canada, I think what's interesting about that is, John, our conversation the other day, I said I didn't know how many provinces Canada had. I'm not a Canada file.
I'm not either.
I did look it up before today. It's 10 provinces. Many of them have larger populations than states in the United States, smaller states, admittedly. And so I don't quite understand how you can say that this enormous, you know, sea to shining sea landmass is one state. I mean, it completely takes the idea of what a state is, renders it absurd. And I don't know what Trump thinks what leverage he's got on Canada.
That's a really interesting point, though. 51st state. It really should be the 51st through 60th state, in other words.
About, yeah, something like that.
And all of them would be blue, by the way.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, they're not going to vote for Trump.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure about Canada's politics. I mean, I was cheered by their election result.
Yeah, ask Mark Carney what the politics have become when Trump is in the mix.
Mm-hmm. Right. There are three provinces that are not there are 10 provinces and three territories. And the territories are lightly populated. So I don't know what you would do with them. But the whole idea that Canadians have so little pride that they would just like to be part of the United States. I mean, that's really what animates this. I don't know exactly what the practical arguments are against it, but it's like saying, okay, Chicago, you're going to be part of Wisconsin now, and that's just a small that would be a small adjustment for us, but it's still like, no, we're Illinois, you know. And I think you would get into people's pride and their identity. And that's, I think, what animated that vote in Canada and will
prevent. It's what elected Donald Trump. I mean, make America great again. And yet he's supposing that the Canadians don't have, even if they don't have the military might we do, they don't have that kind of pride. When you and I talked about it on the radio, I said, look, the people in Ukraine could get the fighting to stop if they would just shrug and say, okay, we're Russia now. It's no big deal. We still live in our houses and we still eat our food and our kids don't get blown up. But they're fighting to the death on that because they don't want to be under somebody else's flag. Austin, what are you thinking about over there?
The escape from Alcatraz, there was a funny observation somebody made that he had both the idea for Alcatraz and the movie tariffs. After watching that movie, being like, oh, we don't make them like this anymore. We got to slap 100% tariff on the movie. But the actual explanation is worse, which is that it's John Voight's like thing that he's been talking about forever. And Voight's been a Trump backer for a very long time. And it's a really bad idea for the same reason that all of our tariffs are a bad idea. But it's uniquely bad in one way, which is that the fake economic argument for tariffs is this whole idea of this trade imbalance, that somehow by paying for things that we value with our money, that we're actually losing all this money to these other countries. But we get stuff for the money. But for movies, it's the other way around. We export a lot. We take in a lot more money from the movies that we make than foreign films. So it doesn't make sense from the whole like illogic that has been, you know, ostensibly what they're using to determine trade policy. It just happens to pet projects.
If there were reciprocal tariffs, the top 10 movies in the world last year were made in America. And if you had the top 100, I would imagine eventually India pops up in there. But I mean, America exports films. If they do a reciprocal tariff, good luck to those distributors who are hoping that the Chinese and the Japanese and the Europeans like our films. I wonder.
There's already the Hollywood is already afraid of the Chinese. They don't make any. There are no Chinese villains in any movies now. Every villain is of some indeterminate, usually Eastern European descent. But Chinese people are always the good guys in Hollywood movies these days.
It's not the strongest part of our economy right now. Between COVID and then the writer's strike, there's been some real setbacks for American-made films. We don't need a thumb on the scale to make it harder.
I do want to just get your guys' opinions, though, on the Trump comment. This Christmas, kids are going to have to do with two dolls instead of 30. That's an attraction, isn't it? Less than a distraction. I mean, it was a weird thing. Then he said they won't have so many pencils, whatever the hell he was talking about the same thing. It's just a weird reference point. But it's the president talking rather than about abundance, about austerity. And that's not what he campaigned on. And that's not what he said when this tariff thing rolled out. But now he's not reading the tea leaves. He's reading the newspaper, and he's starting to talk about being satisfied with less. We don't need all that junk on those container ships.
These are the types of things that Soviet bloc countries would say, right? It's like, why do you need all this choice at the grocery store? Why? Well, we should be thankful that we have one type of mayonnaise, right? And then you go to like an average supermarket in Dallas and you are floored and your head explodes because of the incredible bounty that our markets have provided for us. So just for a politician to tell anyone, you know, it's a very anti-liberty, anti-freedom, like
a billionaire politician
that,
too.
Allies will say that they're for message. Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, it's very frustrating from that perspective. And then from a political perspective, he's trying to do something with his supporters which I'm it's okay to be anti-consumerist. It's okay to say, yeah, maybe you don't need the 15th toy. That's fine. But it's the government shouldn't be telling you how many toys you have. That's the big problem. And that's what he's talking about. And he's trying to do a kind of a cultural shift within MAGA of saying we need to sacrifice so that we can have this kind of made up fantasy life of the 1950s and 60s that didn't actually exist. People think that it was much better, you know, and even, you know, like his, like a white identitarian block thinks that that time was better for them. It was not. It wasn't better for anybody. And it's both of those things combined make it quite frustrating and bad.
But that first part is true, though, right? That if this were a good idea and it took time, we haven't given it time. What a shame that it was maybe going to work, but we just didn't have the patience or the perseverance for it.
He didn't run on saying, everybody, we got to come together and only have two pencils. It's going to take whatever. This is all new messaging. No one voted for that. You know, he's trying to shift. They voted for Trump. I get it. And Trump is shifting his message. But that was
And my argument about China would be that in an authoritarian regime like China has, and a nation that is not used to the luxuries that we're used to, mm-hmm. that if the Chinese government says, you know what, we got this tariff war going on with the U.S., you're going to have to make do with two dolls and five pencils, the Chinese people are much more likely to say, you know, all right, well, you know, if it's going to be good for China, then I can deal with not having as many dolls. The U.S., our mindset is different, and we say, like, you know, hey, you know, you're not the boss of me. You're not going to tell me how many dolls I can buy for my child. Different culture, and we're up against that with China. I think China can has shown in the past and is talking now that they have the will to outlast us when it comes to it. They have a will. They are going to either force their citizens to suffer more, or their citizens are going to gladly suffer more in order to beat the U.S. in this trade war.
Do you think this explains the MAGA base, though? Two dolls? A lot of them are saying, yeah, I'll take two dolls. We can't afford two dolls for every kid in the house. Or the market's crashing. That's okay. I don't have a 401k. I think there is a population that is somewhat insulated from some of these things, and they can still roll with it because they weren't going to have $30 to begin with.
I think that's a really important point. We hear it as let them eat cake. Because we live in an environment where we believe all the things you all just said. I heard an interview with Heidi Heitkamp this morning, the former senator from one of the Dakotas, who said, this is not going to resonate, just what you said, John, not going to resonate with the MAGA crowd exactly, because they see it as a little Trump and his flippancy, and they don't mind it, and they don't take it seriously, and they don't buy $30 anyway. They think he's ribbing the libs who buy all these dolls or something. But she said what is going to sink in are those empty cargo ships and the cost that they have to pay for tariffs. Him telling them you're not going to pay for tariff doesn't ring true to a small business person, the farmers that she sees in the Dakotas who buy equipment, who need the steel from Canada because it's cheaper in order to buy their farm equipment. If they go to the border and try to accept a shipment of whatever they need for their farm and they find out they're paying the tariff, that's when it's going to hit. These sort of comments about dolls and pencils, she didn't think would mean a lot to the MAGA crowd. I don't either. The crowd we really care about is that narrow group of independents who either were regular Republicans or disenchanted Democrats who stayed home and didn't vote for our candidate. And they're the ones we have to watch. And how much does that comment resonate with them remains to be seen.
One other thing you guys might comment on, $5,000 to have a kid and $1,000 to self-deport if you are here without the proper documentation. I could go to Mexico, raise a family, and I think I get $6,000. The administration's thought about $1,000 if you self-deport is they'll buy your plane ticket too. So if you just agree to, they said this is the surest and safest way. Safest is interesting. Safest way to get out of the United States before we come and get you.
From an economist's brain, it makes sense just on a pure dollars and cents level. From a moral level, I don't think you really want to be doing that. However, at the margin, is that better than having people you know, like ICE going and knocking people's doors down and taking them out of the country? Yes. Wow, that's really a wild governance change. On the incentives for the child bearing thing, this is a problem, you know, across the Western world. Like, our fertility rate's just dropping a lot, which means when you think about things like Social Security, those mm-hmm. safety nets are going to collapse. They yeah. really do depend on like a growing population in order to fund them. But it's been proven pretty well at this point over the last 10 years that if you look at like Hungary, for example, gives a ton of money for people who have babies, and it's moved the fertility rate like almost nothing. And so it's a really difficult public policy question, and I don't think the answers to that are clear, but it's the evidence is muddy at best that just paying people cash to have the kid helps.
I would agree with that conclusion, just because it doesn't seem to me that having children is an economically rational thing for people in a non-agrarian yeah. society to do. That if you think of $5,000, you know, it's just that doesn't go very far. I think the cost of raising a child is now? It used to be like $250,000.
$380 or something, $360.
But it's got to be higher. Now, this is when our kids were little. So this is just a drop in the bucket. And like I say, having kids is not necessarily a rational decision. You'll see societies that are really poor and rural, they'll have a lot of kids. And you think, like, why are they having so many kids? They're really poor. You see it in poorer communities, in immigrant communities here, that they have children and it's not necessarily economically rational. So an economic solution to it does seem like it wouldn't work. I would say that seems like a silly thing. I wanted to get back to the self-deportation idea. If you remember, Mitt Romney campaigned on that in 2012. He talked about the idea that if we just made it life harder for immigrants in the country by making it harder for them to work, that they would self-deport. He got mocked a great deal for that notion. But I don't think it was all that irrational to say, like, if you were to actually try to figure out a way to make it so that undocumented immigrants who don't have work papers can't work, can't make money, that people would say, hey, you know, this is not a good place to be. Let's go back home where we can work. And I mean, that makes some sense to me. But the problem with that is that there are a lot of people in the business community don't want that, because they want to hire these people to work in their restaurants and in their fields and so on. They don't want to have e-verify systems. And I know those are problematic and glitchy. But if you were to institute a program where you have to be documented in order to live the kind of life people want to live, I think that would go further to reducing illegal immigration than these kind of ideas.
Well, there is something like that. That's what the I-9 is. When you're hired in this country for something, you are supposed to provide your citizenship as part of your HR documentation. And I read yesterday that ICE is starting to go to businesses that they suspect have a lot of undocumented workers and asking to see all the I-9s that they have on file to prove that. The other loophole, though, the issue about businesses is totally true, Eric. Among the businesses that like to hire cheap undocumented labor is Mar-a-Lago, and they get around that with that HB-1 visa that allows them to hire seasonal workers or temporary workers without needing the I-9s, without the process. And at one point, there was talk about getting rid of them and a lot of pushback against the idea. And I got to think some of the pushback came from Trump himself, because he's got a lot of HB1 folks who work in his landscaping and serving his dinners where he's raking in the money and all the things that he does at Mar-a-Lago. So how that system actually would be set up, I don't know. The idea of providing some cash support for somebody who wants to leave but can't afford to leave, you know, has some interest, but to use it in a threatening manner is where I disapprove.
It's kind of funny, though, isn't it, that on the one hand we said, we'll give you $5,000 if you have kids because we need to continue our population. We'll give you $1,000 if
and
you leave. I know. Yeah. It's like, no, wait, tell those people we'll give you $1,000 if you stay and find a way to get them to pay into Social Security. Actually, a lot of them are. They don't collect. But, I mean, let's just patriate these people, make them happy competent workers and keep them. Then I don't have to have more kids.
Well, they pay $9 billion into Social Security. To Austin's point, we need more money in Social Security, not less. And then we have the added benefit they can't take it out. But that's how it works. But no, I think the whole point of that is we don't want just anybody to have kids. If we pay, somehow they're going to have to figure out how to pay the kind of person that they want to have children. They don't want it to backfire into more babies from families of color, because that's not what they want. I don't know how they'd ever implement that. So I put it in the distraction category.
We're out of time, but I do have the TV schedule here for WLRN in South Florida. And Escape from Alcatraz ran at 9 o'clock local time there, May 3rd. And it was shortly thereafter. And, you know, but that assumes, though, that Donald Trump is clicking around and he's not watching Fox News or hate watching any of the other channels. He clicked over to this Escape from Alcatraz and then stayed on that, maybe watching it for the first time, and then decided to riff on that. There is a paper trail.
I've read it was rerun in the wee hours of the next morning,
which would make sense, too.
Which is when he's more likely to have seen it.
Yeah. That's Mark Halperin, Austin Berg, and Eric Zorn. We're produced by Ben Anderson and Pete Zimmerman, and I'm John Williams. We'll drop another podcast on you next week.
So you want us to go back to green light, red light, yellow light next week?
Yeah, I'll just put something out to. I'll have Pete just send a thing saying let's do it, but we just need to be tighter about it at the end of the pod.
Yeah, I'm going to be stealing the green light concept for my Picayune Sentinel. I've decided I really like it. I like it better than my tune of the week, so I'm going to be alternate putting that in instead.
Well, I'll tell Kate. I think this was her idea. All right, guys, good job. We'll talk to you next week. Thanks, Austin. Thanks, Marge.
John.
Bye.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Bye.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.